This song was originally written by Joe Hill, the preacher and slave.
Holy rollers and jumpers come out. They holler, they jump, and they shout.
Whoop-de-doo.
Give your money to Jesus, they say. He will cure all diseases today. You will leave by and by. Glorious land above the sky,
way up high.
Work and pray.
Live on hay.
You'll get pie in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
If you fight for the good things in life, they will tell you to stop all that strife. You're a sinner and bad man, they tell. When you die, you will sure go to hell.
Go to hell.
You will leave by and by. In that glorious land above the sky.
Work and pray.
Live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
Working folk of all countries unite. Side by side, we for freedom will fight.
We will fight.
When the world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. You will leave by and by. When you've learned how to cook and how to fry,
and bake a pie,
chop some wood, will do you good. And you'll eat the sweet by and by.
That's no lie.
Hi, thank you for joining us at WOB Radio. That means Wobblies, which is a code word, a historical word for the industrial workers of the world. We're a strong union, and we're very proud. We're inclusive of all races, all sexes, all types of people, whether you're working, you're not working, you're retired, or you're a union person already. We accept dual carders. Anyway, this is our monthly radio show, and I'd like to start out by introducing the people that are here at the table, starting out with Marilyn.
Hi, everybody. I'm Marilyn. I am a delegate, which means that if you're interested in joining the IWW, teach you more about it and get you signed up. I've been a member since about 2008, and I'm a retired mental health worker.
Greetings, listeners and fellow workers. My name is Gordon. I live in Bremerton. I'm a retired shipyard worker after 31 years. Been a member of the IWW since 2008, coincidentally, the year I retired. I'm a member of WOB Radio and enjoy participating in the union's activities. I use he, him pronouns in case you need to know, or fellow worker will suit me just fine.
My name is Eric. I've been with IWW since August of 2024, and happy to be here.
And also one of our new producers. Thank you for coming on to the show.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I am the branch secretary of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the IWW. I'm also a delegate like fellow worker Marilyn, so if you're interested in joining the union, typically one of the first people you hear from in the branch is either me or her. I have been a producer and a co-host with WOB Radio for some time. And I'm also a local organizer as well, so feel free to reach out to the Tacoma IWW if you're interested in organizing your workplace.
Hi, and I'm fellow worker Lynn. I've been a member since about 2008. Took a pause for a while for different reasons, and I've been a member again since 2018. I'm a retired social worker and a medical interpreter, traveler, and I'm very happy with the fellowship and the learning that I get through the IWW. So get ready for a really exciting show again.
Yay! And I just want to go ahead and do one more thing here to introduce the show. We in the IWW do recognize the fact that we, here in the Tacoma and Pierce County area, we live on what is historically the lands of the Puyallup tribe. We, of course, support the solidarity that the Land Back movement provides in order to give indigenous peoples all across the country access and autonomy to their traditional lands, and we have been longtime supporters of the Land Back movement. So all solidarity to the Puyallup tribe.
So I will start us off, this is Marilyn, with the preamble. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace as long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possessions of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockdown is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative model, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
So the first article of Labor News that we'd like to share with our listeners today, and this is something that particularly caught my eye because this is an issue that we've discussed on Wob Radio previously with labor officers and union presidents trying to either snuggle up to or separate themselves from the Trump administration. This article comes from Truthout by Emma Lee and M. Karlstad. UAW president is, quote, ready to work with Trump weeks after calling him a scab. So United Auto Workers UAW President Sean Fain went quiet for a few weeks after Trump was reelected in November. Just a few months ago at the Democratic National Convention, Fain was calling on workers to rally behind Kamala Harris to defend democracy and deriding Trump as a scab. Then, in a surprise twist, a day before Donald Trump's inauguration, Fain took to the pages of the Washington Post to announce that the UAW is ready to work with Trump, in quotations. The article further goes on to say that Sean Fain, whose union represents nearly 400,000 workers across the country, from auto workers to adjunct faculty to healthcare workers, could have called out the reactionary attacks against immigrants and trans people and other marginalized people in the country, and called on workers to mobilize and fight back. One of the most significant figures in the new progressive labor bureaucracy, he certainly has the influence. After all, Fain rose to popularity in the fall of 2023 for leading auto workers at the Big Three in a strike that, despite being top-down and bureaucratic, made serious gains for workers. That strike put the working class at the center stage of the political conversation. Biden courted the working class vote by becoming the first sitting president to walk a picket line, while the UAW coyly withheld their endorsement for a time. I have also read a little bit of the Washington Post article. Basically, the long and the short of it is, it's very interesting that someone who touts themselves as very progressive, as well as being a union president, is also trying to justify working with the current administration, either to save the union's own skin or to try and make sure that Trump doesn't try to backlash towards organized labor in any way. And I think that that is kind of a concerning sign of things.
It sounds like maybe Sean Fain is scared of Trump, which is, of course, what Trump thrives on.
There's kind of a difference between how the UAW reacted to Trump and the rise of his administration versus how the Teamsters kind of courted Trump during the election. Fellow worker Gordon?
It would be interesting to know how many active members of the UAW were also Trump voters. And that is perhaps a big schism within the union. And so, you know, not to give excuses to Sean Fain for working with a fascist, if that's what he intends to do, but I can understand some of the motivation because he doesn't want to lose a good chunk of his membership.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say it's self-interest or whatever, but that's kind of a laudatory goal. He's trying to patch things up internally. I disagree with it. I think it's the wrong way to go, but that's a possible explanation for some of what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Gordon.
It's an explanation, but not an excuse, is something I like to say.
Right.
But, you know, again, because I'm also a member of the Teamsters and I attend the local meetings, the internal situation with the Teamsters was they did electronic polling of their members before the election, and the people who responded to their internal online poll of their membership showed a bias towards Trump. I think it was 60-40, 70-30. I can only imagine, and this is just my guess, that the UAW is probably in a similar situation. But the Teamsters, the executive board and the president, even though they've been kind of cuddly towards Trump, ultimately opted not to endorse anybody. And then all of the local districts of the union across the country said, we endorse Kamala Harris because she's not the best, but at least she's vocally pro-labor. Mm. Whereas with the UAW, I mean, they actually attended the Democratic National Convention. Sean Fain called Trump a scab to millions of Americans. Like, that does have a huge impact on organized workers. And yeah, I can understand his decision to try and at least save the union's hide here now that we're entering into a very anti-labor administration.
Didn't somebody from the Teamsters go down to Mar-a-Lago and meet...
Yeah, that was...
The president. The other Sean, Sean O'Brien.
Sean O'Brien.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he has not been popular internally within the Teamsters, I can say that much.
Good.
Which kind of also brings me to the other things that are happening in the clown world that is the current presidential administration. I've also spoken previously on Chavez Dreamer. She is a Republican from Oregon who is also very much pro-labor. She supported the PRO Act when it was entered into Congress, and she's currently being considered by the Trump administration to be the next labor secretary.
So she's a Republican that's pro-labor.
Yes. She is a very interesting contradiction. So the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, is a proposed United States law, such as the National Labor Relations Act, for the purpose of expanding, quote, various labor protections related to employees' rights to organize and collectively bargain in the workplace. So that's just off Wikipedia. So it was kind of an act that was introduced to try and make it easier to organize and have more legal federal protections for workers.
They were big on card check. They were big on that issue. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a Band-Aid. This is my opinion. It's kind of a Band-Aid on a complete laceration of the power of the union. And even if she is pro-labor, quote-unquote, as a Republican, and it's possible, it has happened, she will be essentially neutralized. Because if she's the Secretary of Labor and she doesn't have an LRB to deal with, you know, she can say all she wants, and so she can be a token. Oh, this is our pro-labor person, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so she'll be neutralized anyway.
Or fired, if she speaks out.
Right, let her hang out for a couple of months, unpack, and then fire her.
So I wanted to follow this up with an NBC article, because internally within the Republican Party, Chavez Dreamer is kind of a point of contention for them with the current Trump administration. This is an article by Sahil Kapoor and Matt Dixon. A number of Senate Republicans have problems with the President Donald Trump's nominee for Labor Secretary, former Representative Lori Chavez Dreamer, citing pro-union stances she has taken in the past that clash with the business community. Interesting way of phrasing that. Rand Paul was very vocal, stating that I'm not going to support her. I'm the national spokesman and lead author of the Right to Work bill. Her support for the PRO Act, which would not only oppose national right to work, but would preempt state law on right to work, I don't think that's a good thing.
Well, if Rand Paul hates it, it can't be all that bad, right?
Exactly, yeah. A number of other Senate Republicans also kind of voice their discontent because either they are anti-labor or they're pro-right to work, which is just a nicer way of saying anti-labor.
And or.
But the article goes on to say that for now, at least, Democratic support is uncertain. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, a champion of the labor movement who caucuses with the Democratic Party and is the top Democrat on the committee, declined to comment on her Monday. Quote, there is a process within the hearings. We'll ask her questions and we'll see what she has to say. Asked whether he's open-minded about her nomination, he said, I'm open-minded to everybody. And then the article goes on to talk about the other Republicans who are wary of Chavez Dreamer. She is kind of an interesting woman. You know, Republican pro-labor, like fellow worker Gordon was touching on, is something that you really don't hear in the past few decades. It's kind of something that almost feels anachronistic. But
so who else is he considering for Department of Labor?
She's kind of the top of the ticket for now because she is the only Republican who is vocally pro-labor and has kind of a national standing on that. So she's kind of the only person in line to be interviewed for it, if you will. So kind of an interesting situation there.
But you also mentioned that National Labor Relations Board been jimmied with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we could expand a little on that. The NLRB was established as a result of the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, also known as the Wagner Act. And what this does is establishes a supposedly neutral mediating authority so as to preserve what the phrase was back in the day, labor peace. This, so we didn't have out-and-out battles with Pinkerton cops and union members with guns and sticks and all that kind of stuff like in 1934. So what the NLRB has traditionally done, and it usually is a what they call bipartisan in nature, in other words, whoever's president has a majority on the board as far as the party. So there's usually a bipartisan, quote-unquote, But what has happened is that they've substantially gutted the outfit so that we don't have enough people on the board to have a quorum, which means they're parliamentary hamstrung. And so we can't get any resolutions for legitimate labor problems. And the NLRB is supposed to hear these problems and make rulings on it, much like a court. But it's part of the Department of Labor.
And I actually have an article here from Reuters who specifically talks about a Democratic member that was fired. This was written by Daniel Weissner. So President Donald Trump has fired two Democratic officials at the National Labor Relations Board, a major shakeup that will bring hundreds of cases accusing companies of unlawful labor practices to a standstill and paves the way for Republican control of the agency. Trump specifically removed NLRB member Gwynn Wilcox and General Counsel Jennifer Abruzzo, both appointees of Democratic former President Joe Biden, from their posts on late Monday, earlier this week, according to an agency spokesman. And continuing on from the article, what that basically means is that there's only two people sitting on the NLRB board, which means that they don't have a quorum, which means that they can't hear any of these cases people are bringing to the National Labor Relations Board. There is no federal board to hear these labor charges anymore, essentially. There's just two people who can do nothing.
And it could stay that way for years.
Right.
If he doesn't appoint anybody or if he appoints a complete shill, you know, the effectiveness of the NLRB is essentially evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
Gone.
This is very bad.
Yes.
Sounds rather tactful.
Now, something that we were talking about before the show started is that individual states within the U.S. have their own L&I departments, typically out of the state government. So people can still make NLRB-type charges against their employer on a state basis, but it does not really have as much of an effect as the NLRB charges and justice process in that direction.
Naive question. What is L&I?
L&I, that's
Labor and Industries.
Yes, the Labor and Industries Department of individual states. They also hear charges from workers towards their employers and vice versa. It's just the NLRB makes sure that all of that stuff happens on a federal level as well.
And it might be pointed out that you're also dealing with international, meaning mostly national, unions with hundreds of thousands of members that are from one coast to the other and up into Canada. And so this is where you get dicey in the politics of labor law, because the state can say what it wants, but if you look at the company, if the company has interests in other states, you know, this throws it a monkey wrench into the works. But for smaller, like local unions, it can be a very good tool to use L&I. And last time I checked, L&I had some pretty good people aboard in our state of Washington.
Yeah, so there is still some avenues for workers to get justice against their employers, but on a federal level, things are looking kind of shaky right now.
Very shaky.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder what's going to happen next. Our roundtable discussion today, as we've probably given you the hint of with all the labor news we just covering a very specific president that has just entered office. Donald Trump and his current presidential administration have made it to the White House. They have made a lot of anti-democratic, anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion actions. They have already set about legally marginalizing trans people and immigrants and people of color in the federal and state workplaces especially. And there's just a whole mess of stuff happening right now that I imagine a lot of you have been focusing on in the news. So we just wanted to cover some of the recent actions that have occurred under Trump, as well as where organized labor currently stands in this whole fight. So go ahead, fellow worker Lynn.
Oh, I was going to say, if you haven't been paying attention to the news and the new administration, you probably should.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think there's a temptation to kind of be like, oh my God, all this awful crap is happening all at the same time. I can't engage with this. You know, I have to rest. I have to disconnect. And like, that self-preservation and that necessary rest is a good thing, but completely ignoring the news, I do not recommend. You kind of have to be aware of the damage that's being done in order to try and help and fight back against it.
Well, this ties in with something we discussed previously on the show, which was the nonprofit killer bill,
mm-hmm.
and how I was thinking that foreshadowed what exactly was going to happen when the administration took over, which is, you know, they worded it very broadly, but it was, you know, they want to stop all this woke nonprofit stuff because, frankly, you know, enemy of reaction. But nonprofits include labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
We're 501c5, aren't we? Something like that.
One of those, yeah.
Yeah, but it's nonprofit. That's a very broad category. and so what they're talking about is they want to smash the NAACP. They want to smash you know, outfits that have been around for 100 and more years, like the ACLU.
And they don't care how many Trump voters are in unions. They're probably going to go after the AFL-CIO and the IWW at the same time.
Definitely. Now, as I've tried to reassure some of my comrades in the IWW that we're on the list, but we're kind of like way down the list.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't consider us a threat because of numbers. That's it. We don't have a big bank account. And but remember, the IWW is always more influential out of proportion with its numbers.
And I mean, this is something I've also had conversations with fellow workers like that as well. You know, I really hate to seem like I'm trying to disincentivize people when I say this, but you know, sometimes I hear people saying, well, why don't we take more radical actions? What's the next step going to be? And I agree with that. There should be an escalation to labor organizing, protesting, mutual aid, support for Palestinians and that whole movement that's occurring in the country, support for trans people and that whole movement that's occurring in the country. It's like, yes, there has to be an escalation, but there is a good way and a bad way to go about this if you want to try and keep a target off your back for as long as you can. You're not going to forever going to take the target off your back from people right. like Trump and his administration. But at the very least, you'll stay out of a jail cell for as long as possible. You know, it's not just organized, it's organized right. Keep yourself protected and try to affect what change you can. And if the escalation becomes necessary, then we're capable of getting there.
And as fellow worker Eric was saying, change the things you can.
Mm-hmm.
And don't, you know, try to fight windmills. We can't change the entire society. The best we can work on is our areas of expertise, our own lives, our co-workers. I'm retired, so I don't have any coworkers. It makes workplace organizing a little tough. But, you know, my sympathy is still there, and my work for the union hopefully still helps, and everybody can contribute.
You're mm-hmm. still a member of the community, and you can lend your solidarity, as you were just saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's also something that I've heard is that, you know, things like protest movements or activist organizations or even labor unions, there are multiple different roles you can fill, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that's organizing your workplace, supporting somebody else's campaign, salting by getting hired into somebody's workplace so you can help out their campaign. Or there's also the auxiliary stuff as well, like, for example, this radio show that we produce. You know, this is something that not a whole lot of left-wing or even labor unions have, is a radio show of their own. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, having a good social media presence and inviting people into your organization.
But what I see, you know, we're obviously seeing Project 2025 attempt to bring that here, mm-hmm. even though there was a denial that they were doing that. But I think it goes back further. I think that the attempt is being made to undo everything that Roosevelt did, mm-hmm. from Roosevelt on.
Yeah.
FDR, you mean, yes.
Yeah, the New
yeah.
Deal.
Yeah. We've only briefly touched on it, but there's been a massive amount of deportations, including the detainment of people who are United States citizens,
yeah.
either from Puerto Rico or indigenous reservations, mm-hmm. or people who are from Central and South America who are here legally are also getting detained and possibly put in detention centers.
And we've had detentions here and ICE raids mm-hmm. in Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
And just swept up.
And so the amount of things that have occurred under the Trump administration over the course of a week, because what day is it today? Today that we're recording, February 1st?
Yeah.
It's barely 10 days into his administration, and we're already facing so many crises against all these different groups of people.
And it's planned.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This was all premeditated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the purpose of having so many brush fires, I'll call them brush fires rather than crises, but they're bad. And the purpose is you're so distracted trying to, oh my God, look at that, look at that, look at that, that you become incapacitated to do anything.
Right. Where do you direct your efforts towards anything when it feels like everything's on fire?
Well, and I look at what we see is fascism, and we have an obligation to stand up and fight back.
And most people don't understand what that is or that they're in the middle of it. And so they're not going to be with those of us who are becoming aware of how fast it's going.
Well, that's what happened in Germany.
Well, now the people that are entrenched are business, and when government and business mingle, mm-hmm. isn't that fascism?
Yeah, that's how Mussolini defined it, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what we have. We have Mussolini-style fascism.
Right, except it's by somebody who's somehow even more incompetent. I think that's kind of the only silver lining to this, is the fact that the people, yes, there are smart people who are working for Trump, who know how to do the amount of harm that his administration wants to commit. And I think that that's something I argue with liberals a lot is, you know, all these hicks, the dumb white working class who got completely grifted by Trump to get into the administration, and all the people in his administration must be like that. It's like, no, there are smart people in this administration.
And that makes them more dangerous.
Bingo. Because they have their own personal gain invested in what Trump wants to
do. Yeah, but like Mussolini, These guys, the MAGA movement, has its own squadristi.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wait a minute. What is that word?
Well, it's a condition of the lower bowel. No, squadristi is what the black shirts were for Mussolini. They were the bully boys. They were the enforcers. They were the gang that went around and beat people up, you know, to convince them how great fascism was. So the MAGA crowd already has it, and they released, I don't know how many hundred.
About 1,200, I think.
Yeah, but some of them were truly dangerous. Some of them were the guys who were trying to kill people.
Oh, the January 5th crowd.
January 6th, yeah, outfit. But, you know, like things like the usual suspects, like the 3%ers and Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys.
Right.
There, I called them out. There you go.
No, I mean, I think that the amount of things that are happening, like what Marilyn touched on, it's very easy to get either distracted and specifically overwhelmed. This is something I've been experiencing for the past 10 days of, like, I'll scroll through my Reddit or my Facebook or my newsfeed, and it's just like, here's 7 awful things that happened today. Try to focus on any one of them and think if you can come up with some kind of response to it, right? You know, whether that's helping trans people get healthcare, whether that's providing legal support or cover for people who may or may not have their, you know, paperwork in terms of, you know, immigration, or whether that's, you know, defending LGBT people at large. I think that in terms of organized labor, the situation is a little bit more sticky, because like we covered in the labor news, the UAW president says he's willing to try and work with the Trump administration. The Teamsters went a step further during Trump's campaign and said that they would also work with him as well and cater to him, like, for example, Sean O'Brien and union officials going to Mar-a-Lago. They're trying to stay as warm to the administration as possible under the justification that they can still do all of this working class organizing, either because their membership leans towards Trump, allegedly, or because they just don't want to get outright dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The joke may be on them in thinking that they can work with a dictator.
Mm-hmm. I can speak as a dual Carter with the Teamsters here. Hi, Local 117. I can certainly speak to my end that at least the union members I've talked to always felt a little bit weird about Sean O'Brien cuddling up to President Trump. Even some of the people who tend to sit on the centrist part of the fence of, well, who knows how either candidate's going to turn out, which is a pretty ignorant opinion in my personal view, but
it goes against some pretty deep union DNA.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find a lot of Teamsters, a lot of longshore guys, they just seem to have a reflex that goes toward them. Now, they might be reactionary as hell, and they might want to vote for Trump, but if you start messing with their turf, like the ILA, or the ILWU down in Longview, if you mess with their turf, they have a reaction that goes all the way back to Harry Bridges. It says, no, you ain't messing with our waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of reactionary, but it's also to a good direction, if you will.
And I have an observation that I think you'll agree with. I think that in trade union environments, the American ideology of I'm going to get my bag for me and my family and my community, this zero-sum game mentality can also leak into union spaces, especially within the major trade unions. Mm-hmm. I'm part of a union because I want a better paycheck, because I want better benefits. It loses the language of the collective working class organizing that's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And so this whole contradiction of how can you be a union supporter and a Trump supporter at the same time kind of goes back to that very individualistic ideology of,
right,
I'm in a union, I understand that there's a collective aspect, but I'm here for me. I'm here for me and my bag.
Yeah, that's that competitive thing is kind of uniquely, I'll say North American, because it's in Canada too. I don't know Mexico that well, but I know they have a long, proud history of, you know, activist unions down there.
Ultimately, it's going to take unions and everybody else united to push back against this. So people who are in the union and just looking to take care of themselves and their bag are not looking at the fact that one union alone is not going to win against a dictator and the administration.
That's what they're learning in Utah right now. Have you heard about what's happening at Utah on the state level? This was something I almost put into the labor news, but we might cover it in the next episode. Utah is currently in their state legislature pushing forward a bill that would ban healthcare workers, firefighters, and, get this, police officers from collectively bargaining in their unions.
Yeah.
And so they are having a huge the leopards eating people's faces party is now eating their faces moment, because all of these pro-Trump conservatives in their state legislature, who the police unions and even the firefighter unions apparently cuddled up to, are now coming back to bite them. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to happen to the labor movement, I feel like, as well.
Well, it's like Hatch Act stuff for the federal... I was a federal employee for over 30 years, and we were allowed to be in a union, and we were allowed to wear a political button if we wanted to. But that was about the limit that the federal government allowed. And, you know, I have to admit, it's a good rule, because you don't want people, you know, getting fistfights down in the engine room, you know, over politics, right? So in a sense, it's good. In another sense, it can kind of hamstring, especially a union, you know, who comes out and endorses political candidates. But what I'm getting at is that banning people from organizing, the cops, the EMTs, all these people, the essential workers that these people depend on, is a bad idea. Now, I don't like cops in the labor movement. I don't think the Police Benevolent Association is really a union in that sense of the word, because they're guardians of property. So, you know,
they're a guild.
Yeah, they're a guild-like organization. They're not a union. But anyway, you're right. They're the worm is eating its own tail. The worm Ouroboros, you know, it's eating its own tail. And wait till the tariffs hit. They're gonna, you know, people are gonna be spending $1,000 more for a big screen TV.
This whole discussion about pro-Trump people in major trade unions and how some of these trade unions are trying to at least stay warm with the Trump administration, it brings up the question of what are we actually going to do to convince those workers that maybe they might have made the bad choice? You know, speaking as a local 117 member with the Teamsters, I can definitely kind of recognize and have spoken to some of the people who might have more conservative sentiments within that particular union. And this is something I was talking about before the show. It's not just the individual idea of I'm just in the union so I can personally benefit. There's also the very real reality that Trump appeals to a predominantly white working class community in this country who do feel resentment, who do feel, you know, this disenfranchisement on a political and economic level, and he really sweetens those people up to what he's trying to do with the country based off of that resentment. And I think the conversations that I try to have with those people is that the white working class in this country is disenfranchised. But it's not because they're white or it's because they're men. It's because they're working class. It's because that the political and economic organization of this country is not built to benefit them in the way that they think it does. It's there to make it suffer. And I think a lot of the people who did support Trump, like those police officers, firefighters, et cetera, in the state of Utah, for example, are going to realize that the jig is up. This was never about the white working class. This was always about filling their pocketbooks more. And they're going to feel that. And so that's kind of the approach that I try to take whenever I bump into somebody who's more politically centrist or even, you know, kind of right wing, is kind of, well, no, you're right to feel resentful towards this country. I understand why you might feel an appeal in Trump, but the truth of the matter is his interests have never aligned with yours. Nobody in his administration has material interests in line with yours. And try to wake them up to that fact. And I've had some success in those conversations,
just,
thankfully.
Just hear these words and just watch and listen and read.
Yeah, he's blaming a tragic plane crash on DEI. How does that math actually work out? Is it not also the fact that he's gutted the FAA within a couple of days of getting into office?
You know, I was an adult when Reagan broke the backs of the air traffic controllers.
Patco.
I was living in an apartment in Auburn next to the air traffic control school. All of those people were in school to become air traffic controllers, and the floor was just kicked out from under. And we're going to go through this again.
Yeah. You know, that's actually interesting that you mentioned them, because immediately after Trump accused the FAA and the air traffic controllers and the pilots that were involved in that horrible incident over the Potomac, he started blaming it on DEI. And there was also rumors about one of the pilots being trans, which turned out not to be true. It's a whole weird side story. But the funny thing is that the air traffic controllers union that actually still exists in this country, the one that replaced PATCO, actually made a statement and said, no, it's because we have serious understaffing in air traffic controllers and the people that are responsible for aircraft safety and safe passage and things like that. We have people who are watching the planes and the helicopters at the same time, and normally that's delegated to two different staffs or two different people.
Almost always, I think. This was an anomaly. Someone left early or something. But what a terrible decision to allow that to happen.
Yeah.
two things on this issue, that during the PATCO strike, when he basically, when Reagan basically fired all the air traffic controllers.
Right.
Well, the big hubbub about using active duty military personnel in civilian roles was already, you know, it's been several times that that has happened in United States history. One of them was that if you stop and think about what happens on an aircraft carrier, well, that's a floating airfield. They have air traffic controllers that are highly trained. They got drafted into service, not to make a pun. Same thing with Army Aviation. They've got air traffic controllers. Air Force, all the military, anybody that's got a helicopter or a fixed-wing airplane has got air traffic control at their bases. And that's who was assigned to take the jobs over immediately as an emergency measure. Because you have to have a traffic cop when you're dealing with, you know, 747s. So that was one thing about that. And I forgot what the other thing was.
I guess, you know, the question of where organized labor currently stands in regards to the Trump administration, I think that, again, it's very concerning that some of the larger labor unions are trying to cuddle up to him just to save their own skin under that justification, when the fact of the matter is that it's the rank and file who kind of needs to wake up some of those union officers and be like, no, this is going to severely impact us. We don't have a functioning NLRB that can reach quorum in order to handle unfair labor practice charges against employers.
It'd be a field day. Mm-hmm. And by unfair labor practice, I mean, once again, we're going to define it, flesh it out a little bit. It isn't what many people think it is. I mean, yeah, your boss is unfair. That's not an unfair labor practice. Unfair labor practice specifically entails hindering people from organizing workers. In other words, concerted activity is the term that they use, right? It is legal. And if the employer fires you or has a mandatory meeting to try to dissuade the membership, that's an unfair labor practice. Now, it doesn't always work. It can tie... It gets tied up in court like lawsuits do. And technically, it is kind of a lawsuit. But what I'm getting at is that the more you understand the American labor law and what it provides for, you know, and what it prohibits, you can understand the backdrop against which we have to organize.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that we need to keep our eyes open about disinformation that's being spread.
Yes.
I suspect, Noah, that you were quite aware of some of the disinformation. Part of that, like with the airplane crash, blaming it on supposedly somebody who was trans or somebody who was...
A DEI hire. Yeah.
A DEI hire. That's an example of that.
Unqualified hire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Quote, unquote.
I think I've been listening to the process of Congress listening to the testimony of RFK, who's about to be appointed if we're not careful.
As lunatic in chief of Health and Human Services.
Yeah, and they were asking him very specific questions, and he was skirting the questions. That's another form of disinformation.
All of those guys being interviewed for those cabinet positions are totally evading the questions.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. They're asked over and over, yes or no, will not do it.
I actually wanted to touch really quickly on those Senate hearings about filling some of those cabinet positions and, you know, people who are elected by the Senate in order to fill those cabinet positions. I'm really, again, going back to Chavez de Remer, I'm waiting for that interview because the NLRB being gutted and, for example, the NLRB website just took down, a bunch of federal websites just went down last night so that they can undergo revisions. So there isn't any government official information on your right to organize and how to form a union. I'm waiting to see what Chavez de Remer says about all of this in her Senate confirmation hearing, because I think that having somebody that is such a contradiction within the Trump administration, a Republican who's very pro-labor, is going to be, I think, a signal of things to come. I'm waiting to hear her answers about what she's going to do for organized labor, because, again, I personally am very skeptical as to how effective she's going to be in defending labor rights as Secretary of Labor. But if she does manage to buck a little bit of the Trump administration off of her back for the better, I'm interested in seeing what happens there.
See, and I predict if she does do that, she'll get fired.
Oh, absolutely.
Like
that. I think that organized labor does stand a kind of a fighting chance against what a lot of the Trump administration is doing. It's just reaching out to the rank and file and getting some of them who were Trump sympathetic or Trump supporters to kind of realize what's going to happen for their livelihoods now that there's a huge anti-labor crackdown that's
about
to happen.
So what you're talking about basically is that you're waiting for the solidarity to happen.
I want to make the solidarity happen myself. Good. This is the reason why, you know, I am a firm IWW member and supporter. I'm the branch secretary, for God's sakes. But on the other hand, I'm still going to those local 117 meetings. Mm-hmm. I'm still talking to those people. Yeah. And even though I have skepticism about the whole bore from within strategy in order to try and make trade unions more class conscious or more like the IWW, I think that that's a whole nother discussion we could have on the radio. I still think that talking to those people is important and making them realize your livelihood, your wages, hours, and conditions that your union exists to defend is seriously on the cutting table right now. And so I'm trying to do that fight in the way that I can.
And so also a good point to bring up that union locals vary in political outlook and activity from local to local. If you go down to the Bay Area, the ILWU locals down there will shut that port down mm-hmm. if they think that you're shipping illegal arms or something like that. They've shut it down before. Whereas the guys in Longview may be a little more conservative in their outlook. But so it varies from local to local within a big union.
That's a good true. Point. Well, we have Marilyn, you wanted to talk about Leonard Peltier finally being free?
Finally, after all these years, Leonard Peltier is out of prison.
All right.
He's on house arrest. He's over 80 years old. He's in failing health. I wish that they had just either pardoned him or completely dropped the case, but they didn't. He's on house arrest, but that's a hell of a lot better than prison.
Absolutely.
I'm so glad that he's yes. back on his reservation with his people.
Well, we in Tacoma, among many, many others in other cities, used to march for his release.
Every year.
Mm-hmm. It's been a long-standing campaign to get him out of prison as well.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Thanks to Arthur Miller.
Well, and his ex-wife lives here mm-hmm. in Tacoma, and he's got a son that lives here.
Chauncey.
So we have a connection.
And the Tacoma IWW long was in affiliation with the Leonard Peltier Defense Offense Committee.
That's right.
And we supported them in solidarity action on some of their parades and some of their marches.
And I want to, in case there's any old-timers listening, I want to do a shout-out for Arthur Miller, longtime IWW member who has since passed on. It's really a shame that Arthur is not alive
right.
to see Leonard finally out of prison.
Arthur Miller Presente.
Presente.
Yeah, Presente.
I would have never expected it. Since it took so long for Biden to get to it, I just didn't think it would happen. Mm. So wonderful. So late, though.
At least he can, you know, a person has dignity. You know, a federal prison is no place to try to preserve your dignity. He can be amongst his relatives and relations, and he can pass on in peace.
Fellow worker Gordon, did you want to present your book report?
Yeah, briefly. Listeners and fellow workers, I'm going to do a little review of a very recent book. Usually I'm digging into all the historical tomes and things from 100 years ago, but this was published in 2024, and the book is called The Hammer, Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. And it's a book written by a labor reporter whom I'm not familiar with, but I am, you know, through reading this book. And his name is Hamilton Nolan. It was published by Hachette Books, H-A-C-H-E-T-T-E, out of New York. And like I said, this is a 2024 publishing, so it brings things a lot more up to date as far as the current struggle in labor. And what this is, the guy's a journalist and he writes like a journalist. So it's a much more accessible form of writing because it, you know, it sounds like a news story and it's got a lot of human interest in it because that's what journalists do. They draw out people and their individual stories like Studs Terkel did. He wrote a great book called Working, and he had just...
Great writer.
He had hundreds of interviews with working people and what it was like back in the bad old days. Anyway, this guy, whom I've never heard of, did just that, and he also used a literary device wherein he takes one major story or theme or person, and he uses that as an example, a microcosm, for what is going on in the big picture. And so... What Mr. Nolan has written, or fellow worker Nolan has written, is principally a story about Sarah Nelson. And I didn't know too much about Sarah Nelson except that I had heard her name. And she was kind of firebrand union activist from the Flight Attendants Union, the Association of Flight Attendants, AFA. And, you know, I've heard of her, never heard her speak, but sounds like a real fireball. But the funny thing is that she was a kid from the Midwest and grew up with the idea of becoming a flight attendant. And it's like white picket fence and, you know, a nice high school prom. And she was apparently an attractive-looking woman and so fit right into what the program was back in the 60s.
When they were stewardesses.
When they were stewardesses. And it was a different outlook on what they were supposed to do.
You had to be a certain height, a right. certain weight.
And you had to be subservient. Let's put
you
it that way.
You went to charm school.
Exactly.
And you had to be childless.
That's right. I forgot about that part.
I knew somebody that was a nurse, and she got pregnant, and she had to
That's
quit.
That's right.
Or they fired her.
That's crazy.
That's right.
But anyway, he uses the story of Sarah Nelson, and he comes back to her because this woman, I'm telling you, she had a lot of problems. She found out she was already president of the AFA, and she went out for a jog or something and fell and found out as a result of her injuries that her hips were going out. She had bone on bone. She didn't know anything about it till she fell. Had a catastrophic accident. So she went through two hip surgeries, and she went through a lot of psychological problems, as well can imagine. Here's your whole image of yourself, and it's collapsed. And she had a family that she was helping raise. And the thing is that she kept coming back, and she campaigned and she ran the union from like her sick room until she got better. And she got reelected president of the Association of Flight Attendants. So he uses her story starting with her and her problems and the sort of indomitable spirit that she had, but not as an individual. This guy definitely doesn't believe in the great man, great woman syndrome. He believes in solidarity. You can tell just through his style, it just comes out. And he was obviously pretty impressed with this woman who was trying to run for president of the AFL-CIO. And that was what I think a fellow worker, Alan, wanted to talk about. And that person is currently still the AFL-CIO president named Liz Schuler. And she comes out of the old mold. What this guy is telling us is that activists, he focuses in on the Culinary Union in Las Vegas, Nevada, and Unite Here, which is the hotel workers in Miami, Florida. And he says these are majority women of color. They're your room cleaners. They're your kitchen workers. A lot of them are immigrants. A lot of them are undocumented immigrants, and so highly vulnerable. And yet, you know, these outliers to what the typical union movement is all about and the typical portrait of a AFL-CIO affiliate, they were firebrands, started their own unions within the major union and transformed. Right now, Las Vegas is a union town. Mm-hmm. The Culinary Union works the hotels, the casinos, the restaurants, the bars, you know, everything down there, which is, of course, entertainment oriented. Las Vegas with no tourists ain't Las Vegas anymore. You know, it's a ghost town. So they realized that. They were politically savvy enough. We were talking earlier also about this part of being politically savvy. They organized through the union. And when there was down there, you talked about what happened in Florida. There was a hurricane, Hurricane Ida, I think. And it just wrecked all these people's lives in that corridor of Florida that has Disney World and all that kind of stuff. A lot of people out of work. The union, check this out, went down their lists on their iPads or whatever, went to every union household, gave them checks for groceries. This is from the union, out of the union funds. You don't hear about this kind of, you know, when was the last time steelworkers delivered a check to you when you were on strike? Well, they did that, and it's sort of stepping out of the typical workplace organizing thing. Now, in our union, the IWW, there are a couple of different schools of thought. Some people tend to be more traditional, that we should be, you know, like workplace organizing. I'm kind of in that camp. But I've also had my attitude changed by understanding that community organizing, labor organizing, can go hand in hand.
Absolutely.
And that's what this gentleman here is talking about, this fellow worker. And he writes well. He's got a sense of humor, so you'll find it to be amusing. It reads kind of like a novel. And I have to admit, full disclosure, I am not done with the book yet, but I will be, Moshtik. Yeah.
Are you one of those kinds of people who gets halfway through a book and then the latter half, it just takes so long to finally finish?
I already know what it is. So I am projecting a little bit. But what I'm saying is that the trajectory of the book notices the conjunction between the community and the labor force. I think I mentioned that before, working up in Bellingham and Mount Vernon with Familias Unidas. When they go on a picket, the whole family comes out. Abuelita and baby and everybody comes out. And it makes it sort of a family affair, right? Well, what this guy is trying to tell us is that that kind of thing is possible and, you know, and admirable. And it fits in with the idea of organizing the working class as a class. So in my limited time, without rambling on, I recommend this book. It is an excellent read. Hamilton Nolan. And if you look at the book jacket, a lot of familiar labor authors have, you know, given him a shout out, like Stephen Greenhouse and Kim Kelly and Rick Perlstein and Steve Early and other labor writers that you'll be familiar with. So get this book. It's up to date. It'll inspire you. It'll give you some news about the labor struggles around the country, and you can go out and kick some management ass.
What's the name of the publisher for people who are interested?
The publisher's name is Hachette Books. I spell H-A-C-H-E-T-T-E, out of New York. And I think I got this through AK Press.
Okay.
I'm not sure where I bought it through. But I saw it. It looked like a good read. And I've been struggling with some of them old-timers like Kropotkin. I'm still laboring through, you know, the conquest of bread. So maybe I should go back to college and get a degree in that.
Try an audiobook sometime.
I don't know. This is the pretty 19th century. But my point is that Hamilton Nolan is up to date. He writes lovingly and he writes spiritedly about the new labor movement, what's coming in after. He marks it like from the time of COVID and how that wiped out so many union jobs and how we've rebuilt. So if you're interested in organizing your workplace, one critique, though, he does get our name wrong. I looked in the index. I always look for IWW footnotes and stuff, and he calls us the International Workers of the World. That one little mistake. Come on, it's a good book.
I hear that sometimes.
Yeah. We've made the mistake ourselves, I'll wager. But get the book. It's called The Hammer, and it's all about a current labor struggle.
We are coming up to the end of our show here, so let's touch on some local events that are previous and upcoming.
I want to tell the listener that Angela Davis is coming to Olympia. She will be at the Capitol Theater February 21st at 7 o'clock.
I just mentioned her autobiography on a recent episode of WAB Radio, and her story and her activism and her life is just, it's inspiring, the work that she's done over the decades. I wanted to talk really quickly about the local events that recently occurred here in Tacoma. As some of you might be aware, there was a big protest on January 20th here in downtown Tacoma. It started at Fireman's Park and then marched down to the federal courthouse. Just across the street from the University of Washington, Tacoma.
And it was cold.
Yes, it was cold. Good. A cold protest is seldom fun to attend, but just make sure that you bring enough winter coats, especially in this time of year. We got to get connected with a lot of cool local organizations that have been really doing a lot of great solidarity work and working class organizing. There was the Democratic Socialists of America here in Tacoma. There was the FRSO, which is the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. There's the Tacoma IWW, of course, we were in attendance, as well as the Climate Alliance of the South Sound, and Jewish Voice for Peace. I didn't really see any other union represent themselves the way that the IWW did. You know, they weren't carrying a banner, but I know that there were other union folks in the audience as well.
And they were Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
There were members of the faith community that have taken on the issue of what's going to happen now that Trump is in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who else? There were Raging Grannies there. There were members of The Conversation that were there. There were members of the Urban League, members of many different women's rights groups and LGBTQI groups.
It was a whole coalition of people, and it was nice to really kind of bump elbows with all the people that have been doing work.
There were actually 18 groups.
Yeah. It was good turnout. We had several hundred people, I think, in that march.
Actually, the Tacoma News Tribune, and this surprised me, reported over 350 people there.
Yeah. It was surprisingly good, you know. I kind of mentioned this before the show started. It seemed like a lot of the protest activity with the second Trump administration didn't really seem like the way it was with the first Trump administration, but there was still really good turnout nonetheless, and I'm very happy that that happened.
I learned a lot about providing security because I was on the security team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be very useful in the coming days in doing any activity.
Right. Be mindful of your surroundings, be mindful of police presence, be mindful of agitators. If you see something, say something.
Mm-hmm.
Learn how to de-escalate those situations. Yeah.
Right.
I've done that work previously during the Black Lives Matter protests in Tacoma as well. Something I also wanted to touch on.
Oh, Black Panthers were there too.
Yeah, the Black Panthers were there. It was good to see them. The Tacoma IWW also tabled at the January 25th organizing fair. That was also really cool to be a part of because, again, it was kind of like all the organizations that were present at that January 20th protest had a fair, and to kind of connect with members of the community, people who wanted to get more involved in whatever avenue of activism they felt like.
Shout out to the Democratic Socialists of America in Tacoma for organizing that.
Mm-hmm.
They did an excellent job.
No, it was nice to have their support. And specifically for the IWW table, we had a lot of, there was a whole bunch of people that walked up and, you know, signed on to our little sign-up sheet and got to talk to Marilyn and me. It's interesting the kind of people that were coming up to our table, though. I had a couple of small business owners come up to me, or like managers of local nonprofits, and be like, I want to help support the labor movement better, but I'm kind of in this awkward position of I have higher firepower, or I'm a manager for this nonprofit.
Oh.
What do I do? I want to be more pro-labor, and, you know,
well,
I want to support.
They might have just been mining us.
I always lead with, assume that this person has good intentions unless they show the other half of their face, you know what I mean? And so I answered their questions as sincerely as possible and just said, look, if you want to support your workers better, just let them organize. Let them form a union and don't get in the way when they want to, you know? Try to, you know, if they come before you and say, hey, we want to have a union in the workplace, don't make them go through the electoral process. Just voluntarily recognize them and start the negotiations from there. I've also had the conversation with a few nonprofit people as well who have been part of local nonprofits for a while, and they're like, you know, we want to make sure that the people who work for us are better supported. And I'm like, let them form a union then. And so it was kind of interesting to have those kinds of conversations, because I've never had that asked of me before as somebody who's done local organizing work.
I've got it from the other side. I've got it from workers who say, well, you know, my boss, you know, it's a family-owned business. There's only about 25 of us there. They treat us real nice. You know, we get good Christmas bonus, you know, and why should we have to form a union, you know, if we got a good boss? It's the good boss syndrome. And what I try to answer them is that by forming a union, you're not confronting them. You're just getting together to give your point of view to each other. Remember, we talked about shadow unionism before. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, even if you're not in a formal union, act like you're in a union. Conduct yourself like that. You don't have to be mean to your good boss, but you might want to have a healthcare plan that could be down the road a little.
Or if you like those Christmas bonuses, you can have it as part of your contract that they always happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or yeah, you can work that in, and you can still keep your good boss, and they can still keep a good workforce. So, you know, if they're truly of that mind, you know, then we'll see what happens.
Well, and I also say the boss giveth and the boss can take it away.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
What if the boss sells the business?
Then you're screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The new boss doesn't have to recognize your union or your informal group. But it still works to solidify your co-workers in a group of people that can act together.
I was also tabling for Radio Tacoma at that. And the table next to us was a group that was helping people do cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
And they were offering legal advice. They had attorneys. And it was a free group. And since it says right in our preamble to abolish the wage system, cooperatives are definitely something that's consistent with the IWW. So I got a lot of information from them. And I'm going to follow up for the Solidarity Center, which is where we meet, because they've been wanting to form a cooperative for a long time. And I'm going to try to help that happen.
Cool. Let me know how that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to thank all of our fellow listeners for tuning in. Once again, this is WOB Radio, W-O-B Radio. This has been a production of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, labor union of all industries. If you're interested in organizing with your coworkers in your workplace, you can feel free to reach out to us at tacoma@iww.org. That's our email. Or you can reach out to us on our Facebook page or our Instagram page as well. Just Tacoma IWW is the name of the both of them. I also want to thank our broadcasters, both locally and across Washington State, specifically 101.9 KTAH Radio Tacoma, 95.3 KTQA up in Hilltop, Tacoma, and 94.9 KZAX in downtown Bellingham. We thank you for carrying the message of our union to all of the working class people in your communities. Solidarity.
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 And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH.